Proceed to the third case of the day, Erb v. Alliance Capital. Mr. Moley.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jim Moyle on behalf of Appellant Alliance Capital Management. May it please the Court. The named plaintiffs here are investors in an Alliance Capital Fund, a premier growth fund, and also an institutional investor whose investment portfolio is being managed by Alliance Capital. Plaintiffs allege that Alliance Capital represented that it purchased only one rated stocks, meaning Alliance Capital's highest rated stocks for funds and other client accounts. Plaintiffs further allege that this was a uniform policy applicable to all clients of Alliance Capital's large cap growth team. This representation purportedly was made in certain prospectuses and marketing materials. In asserting a breach of contract claim, plaintiffs do not, however, point to any signed contracts between the parties or to language in any prospectus that contains this so-called one-rated stock restriction. Instead, they cite only to two pages from an unidentified document that they attach to the amended complaint. Now, that document certainly doesn't look like a contract, doesn't have anything identifying the parties, doesn't have anything identifying the promises made, and it doesn't have anything identifying the consideration that was made for the promises. Nonetheless, plaintiffs filed this class action in state court for breach of contract, alleging that Alliance Capital breached its agreements with plaintiff by investing in stocks that were not one-rated, as promised. Appellant's position is that no matter how plaintiffs dress up their claims, they are preempted by SLUSA if SLUSA's elements have been satisfied, meaning in this case, there's a covered class action, the claim is based on state law, the defendant is alleged to have made an untrue statement, and the untrue statement was made in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. Here, plaintiffs have conceded 1, 2, and 4, so the only question is whether or not the district court erred in finding that the amended complaint does not encompass any untrue statement. Now, again, the alleged untrue statement is that Alliance Capital purchased only one rated stocks for its clients. And if you look in the appendix at pages 19 and 20, you'll see several times that plaintiffs make that statement. And it's true that plaintiffs do not use the word misrepresentation, nor do they assert that Alliance Capital acted knowingly and breaching its promise. To do so, of course, would bring the claims squarely within SLUSA. But whereas here Congress has been clear that it intended to completely occupy the field of certain types of securities transactions, like those falling under this statute, courts may look beyond the face of the complaint to analyze the substance of the allegations being made. And it's plaintiff's own definition of the class in this case that demonstrates, under plaintiff's theory, the existence of untrue statements. At page 20 of the appendix, you'll see in plaintiff's amended complaint their class definition, and it's pretty long, so I won't read through it. But suffice it to say that plaintiff's class includes all mutual fund investors and all institutional accounts who owned and held mutual fund shares or accounts during the period. That's basically what the class definition says. They look at mutual fund shareholders and account holders, and they say, if you owned mutual fund shares or you owned an account during the period and held it, you're part of the class. In this way, the class is defined as not exclude people who bought mutual fund shares or who opened accounts after non-one rated stocks had already been purchased by Alliance Capital for the fund and all its clients, allegedly in breach of the so-called agreements. So each potential class member who bought a share in the fund after the fund already owned non-one-rated stocks was buying pursuant to an untrue statement. And that's the issue in the case. That's what the district court decided this on, whether or not there was, in fact, a misrepresentation. And the same is true here with regard to the institutional investors. Any client who opened an account after the large cap growth team had already been buying non-one rated stocks for its clients, supposedly in violation of this agreement and this representation that they will only buy one rated stocks, was acting pursuant to an untrue statement. Now, it doesn't matter that plaintiffs don't want to allege that any statements were untrue or that Alliance Capital acted knowingly, as long as the claim may be read that way. And here, in light of the class definition, it must be read that way. The statutory requirements have been met, and the claim is preempted. If we take a look, at a timeline, I think that it will crystallize the issue. On day one, if an investor buys shares, and I'll look at the mutual fund. Day one, an investor buys shares in the mutual fund. And when he does that, he's promised, as plaintiffs contend, that Alliance Capital invests in only one-rated stocks. Day two, Alliance Capital loads up the mutual fund with stocks that are not one-rated, 2, 3, and unrated stocks. At that point, investor A arguably would have a breach of contract claim against Alliance Capital because he or she bought shares in the mutual fund. The representation was, we'll only invest in one-rated stocks. There were only one-rated stocks in the portfolio. And if at some point down the road then Alliance Capital invests in two-rated stocks or something else, then that person may be able to say, hey, look, you made a representation, you made a promise to me, and it was breached a day, 2 days, a year later when you invested in stocks that were not one-rated. Well, let's move to day three, after the fund has already started investing in stocks that are not two-rated. And at that point, investor B comes along, who's also a member of the class as it's defined by plaintiffs. And that person invests in the fund. Same representation is made that Alliance Capital invests only in one-rated stocks. But at the time he buys, and at the time that representation supposedly is being made, the fund is loaded with two-rated stocks. At that point, that investor is buying pursuant to an untrue statement. And, of course, if there's an untrue statement in connection with the purchase or sale of covered securities, under the statute, the claim is preempted by SLUSA. That's what takes it away from the allegation that all this is a simple breach of contract case, because the class as defined includes people who are buying pursuant to a misrepresentation. Therefore, that element has been met, and therefore the claims are barred by SLUSA. This, of course, is consistent with the court's recent decision in Kircher, where the court looked at a class and noted that because the definition of the class included people who held shares during the class period, that necessarily included people who not only held shares during the class period, but at some point bought the shares and later, of course, continued to hold them for some period of time after they bought them. And that case, too, involved fund shares, so it's applicable here. Another case on point is Hardy in the Southern District of New York, where the court said, hey, look, when you can't distinguish between people who are in a class, where some class members may have claims that are barred by SLUSA and some class members may have claims that are not preempted by SLUSA, the only thing to do is to dismiss the complaint in its entirety because the elements of SLUSA have been met with regard to some class members, and it's not the court's job to try to unmix the scrambled eggs. Same thing with Dabit. Of course, Dabit ruled that holders' claims are not covered by SLUSA, so it's inconsistent with Kircher in that regard. But the Second Circuit also found that where a class consisted of holders and purchasers with regard to some of the claims, it must be dismissed. And there, too, the court found that it was reasonable to require plaintiffs specifically to exclude any class members who purchased in connection with the misrepresentation or untrue statement. And that's what we would suggest would be required here. Are we saying that plaintiffs under no circumstances could have a breach of contract claim? Absolutely not. What would be required in order to have that breach of contract claim? You would have to define your class so that a number of the class members were not purchasing securities pursuant to an untrue statement or a misrepresentation, because at the time the fund is loaded up with stocks that make the representation at the time you're buying or opening your account actually untrue.
You know, you're going to, I'm sure we're going to hear from the other side saying that Kircher dooms your case here. But what's the status of a case like this in the future with the new federal class action fairness act that was passed?
Well, I think
would even a breach of contract case like if this were just a breach of contract case, be required to be brought in federal court. Is that
yeah,
statute?
I'm not sure entirely, but my understanding is that the new Class Action Fairness Act certainly evinces a congressional intent that cases like this be brought in federal court. So down the road, it may resolve the issue. But you know, right now, I think we're still confronted with the issue here as to whether or not you know contract claims can be brought. Let me rephrase the issue. Here, I think the clear issue is whether or not if a claim can be a contract claim,
well,
and it also is a misrepresentation.
Can artfully plead very carefully to avoid having to go in federal court, you can do it. But whether you can do that under Kircher here is an interesting question. And you only spent a few seconds talking about brushing off Kircher, but I think we're going to hear from the other side that it's really...
I'd like to respond that if I may, but I see my time
no,
is up.
No, you may respond, and I have another question, Mr. Moyle, too. So, but go ahead and respond, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to Kircher, I know there's language in Kircher that suggests that while this isn't a case where a promise in a mutual fund was broken and therefore a remedy would exist under state law. That statement, I think, is consistent with the theory that we have here. You can have a breach of contract claim in state law, assuming that the elements of SLUSA have not been met. And here, where you have all the elements, concededly three of them, the fourth one, whether there's misrepresentation at issue, that's where we come out on this. If you meet all those elements, and there's what can also be a breach of contract claim, congressional intent to occupy the field says that claim must be brought in federal court. Now, Kircher doesn't suggest, I don't think, that there has to be, in fact, it suggests quite the opposite, that there has to be, for example, a strong federal claim with regard to the allegations. In fact, you know, Kircher goes out of its way to say that, look, when the elements of SLUSA have been met, even weak federal claims should be brought in federal court, and especially the weak claims. And that may be the situation that plaintiffs are confronted with here.
All right, we're going to convert this to a 15-minute argument, and because I want you to address the question of appellate jurisdiction, Mr. Moyle.
Sure.
And so, obviously, you know, the time is compensated on both sides.
Yeah, with regard to appellate jurisdiction, the background here is that plaintiffs cast this case initially as a holder's claim. And they did that pre-Kircher in order to, you know, be able to bring the claims in state court before we knew that holders' claims also fell under SLUSA. And initially, the district court remanded the case without the benefit of oral argument. And in the decision, the court cited a series of cases that said where plaintiff has alleged a holders' class, those cases are properly remanded to state court. Subsequently, plaintiff amends their complaint. And when they amend their complaint, they do more than just add a couple of plaintiffs, as the plaintiffs here would like to suggest. What they did is they added the institutional accounts. And the institutional accounts, the only security that's at issue when you're looking at those accounts to decide whether or not the in connection with requirement has been met, is the purchase and sale of the non-1 rated stocks. So what we did is we looked at that amended complaint and said, my gosh, you know, initially we had the mutual fund claims where one could question whether or not holders of mutual fund claims would be able to bring their claims in state court, again, pre-Kircher, because they didn't do anything. They bought their mutual funds, simply held it, and that's all. But when they added the institutional investors, whether or not they held an account is irrelevant because there's no security transaction going on.
Well, any of the arguments that you've made now not available after the first remand order?
Well, certainly Kircher, you know, changed the landscape, yes, significantly with regard to whether or not the holders' claims would survive. But we didn't feel that we were able to appeal the initial decision because that, too, was pre-Kircher in the sense that you're dealing with the jurisdictional issue as opposed to the merits of the second Kircher decision. So we didn't think that appeal was available to us. And absent an amended complaint, we would be pursuing our claims or defending our claims in state court. It's the amended complaint that changed everything. And, of course, the statute says that once there's an amended complaint, You have 30 days to remove. We promptly filed our removal papers. We complied with the statute completely. This is not like the many cases at plaintiff's site where a defendant waives its opportunity to remove by doing nothing and then seeks to fix later the waiver problem. We followed the removal procedures precisely with regard to the initial complaint and then with regard to the amended complaint. So we believe very clearly there's nothing that precludes a second removal. In fact, the statute says it's appropriate to remove. And indeed, this court in the consolidation case says, gosh, you know, we're not going to preclude, in essence, second bites at the apple with regard to removal claims, because to do so would encourage plaintiffs simply to be coy in filing their initial complaint, and then if the matter is remanded, defendants would not have an opportunity to again seek removal when something changes.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Grady.
Good morning, and may it please the court. You're probably not surprised that I would love to jump right away into Judge Evans' comment that I would argue that Kircher dooms this appeal. I love the choice of words, but first I'd like to just follow up and bring some closure to the questions that you had asked Judge Flom regarding the jurisdiction. I don't believe that there is appellate jurisdiction in this case, as we have argued both in our motion to dismiss and in the briefs that we filed with the court. The relief sought by way of this appeal was available after the first remand order. The fact that Kircher had not then been decided is one that we agree on, but as this court said in Kircher 1, the jurisdictional opinion, it didn't change the law. It was simply interpreting the law and finding that there was, in fact, appellate jurisdiction. The Kircher defendants faced the same decision as did Alliance Capital, and yet they chose to appeal. Alliance Capital chose not to. It was its strategic decision. It didn't appeal. Therefore, the court does not have jurisdiction. Now, as far as the differences between the complaints that would suggest some kind of a revival of a right to seek removal that would somehow then create an additional opportunity to review, I would simply refer the court to the Wilson versus the Big Ten Conference opinion, which this court decided, where you looked at the initial complaint that was filed, compared it with an amended complaint, noticed a number of differences, but the essence in the complaint had not changed at all. It's the exact same situation here. The essence of the initial complaint was not so narrow as Alliance Capital pretends it to be. The essence of the initial complaint was that the Alliance Capital large cap growth team managed portfolios for a lot of clients, including the Premier Growth Fund. If you look at the initial complaint, you'll see references to those other clients throughout the complaint. You could literally take the initial complaint, change other clients, plug in Aladdin, and you have the amended complaint, because they both talk about the portfolios managed by Alliance Capital. And that brings us right into the issue about whether SLUSA in some way preempts this appeal. Alliance Capital, in order to achieve its goal here, would essentially have to be able to meet its burden of proving that the case that we have filed, a breach of contract case involving a fiduciary relationship, isn't a breach of contract case involving a fiduciary relationship, and couldn't be and could never be. Alliance Capital, in essence, wants to say the law of fiduciary relationships, the law of trust, the law of contracts, that's all now preempted by SLUSA if there's a security out there somewhere. I would respectfully suggest that there is no court, including this court in Kircher, no court that has found where there is an investment advisory relationship between an investment advisory client and an investment advisor that breach of contract or breach of fiduciary duty claims are preempted by SLUSA. This court in Kircher 2, as I'll call it, the more recent decision, not the jurisdictional decision, was dealing with a mutual fund only. In this case, as counsel has correctly noted, we not only have Ms. Erb, who's a shareholder in the mutual fund, but we have institutional accounts represented by the Aladdin Retirement Trust. And as I listened carefully to Alliance's argument this morning, they have in essence conceded that Aladdin has a claim for breach of contract, because when Aladdin contracts with Alliance Capital, there isn't an existing pool of stocks. There isn't an existing portfolio. Rather, Alliance Capital is arguing only with respect to the fund that because there are already stocks in that fund, when a shareholder buys shares, that somehow there's this SLUSA in connection with it that causes preemption. We do not concede despite what you heard this morning and despite what you have read in the briefs of Alliance Capital, we do not concede that the elements of SLUSA are met here with the exception of the first two. Yes, it's a covered class action. Yes, very definitely it's in connection with the state common law theories of contract in the context of a fiduciary relationship. There is no in connection with, there is no purchase or sale, and there is no covered security. And the best description of that is found in a Southern District of New York opinion. I was glad that opposing counsel referred to the Hardy opinion, because a more recent opinion out of the same court, the Southern District of New York, entitled Norman versus Solomon Smith Barney.
Have you informed the other side of this opinion?
Your Honor, in two ways we have. We actually filed yesterday a notice of supplemental authority, which I believe was not necessary. This opinion was cited by the Breakaway Solutions case that was cited in the party's briefs, which I didn't realize as I was reviewing the materials. I noticed this case and it didn't immediately ring a bell. So it's cited by the Breakaway Solutions Court, the Delaware Chancery Court, and at that time only had a Westlaw citation. It now has a Southern District citation. It was actually decided in June of 2004. It is the only case that I have been able to discover that deals with this issue. That is, an investment advisory client doing business with an investment advisor, in that case bringing a breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract claim against the investment advisor. Solomon Smith Barney argued preempted, SLUSA, just like all these other dozens and dozens of cases that have been filed. The court probably is aware that the majority of the SLUSA opinions have to do with investment analyst research claims. Call it bias, call it conflicts, call it fraud. It all relates to investment research opinions by brokerage firms, not investment advisors, that plaintiffs allege are false or misleading. So if you look at what's pled in those cases, and this is what the courts refer to, I believe, Judge Evans, as artful pleading. If you look at those cases, the plaintiffs say, we were misrepresented. These really weren't the true opinions. They were misleading us. We relied on them. We bought securities. And notwithstanding all of that, we have a claim for breach of contract. And the courts are saying, no, you really don't. You've alleged a typical securities fraud claim. You have a typical securities fraud claim. Therefore, SLUSA preempts. No court has preempted where there's a fiduciary relationship between an investment advisor and an investment advisory client. The court in Norman did a great job, I think, in describing the relationship there, and I'd like to just read briefly a couple of the excerpts. Beginning at head note 4, here the gravamen of the complaint is plainly a straightforward breach claim. Plaintiffs purchased a service, portfolio management, pursuant to a contract, paid the fees for that service under the contract, and now allege they didn't get what they paid for. It's exactly the same situation here. The plaintiffs purchased a service, portfolio management. Ms. Erb purchased her service by becoming a shareholder in a mutual fund to benefit from the economies of scale available through that means of investing. Aladdin invested directly with Alliance Capital, both of them getting portfolio management services. So even if Alliance Capital was somehow successful in persuading this court that there really is a misrepresentation or omission out there somewhere, it's not in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. As the Norman Court points out, it's in connection with the rendering of services. The Second Circuit in Dabbitt makes clear that there's a distinction to be drawn. If it has to do with services, even though they pertain to securities, it's not barred by SLUSA. It's not in connection with a purchase or sale. So here we don't have the misrepresentation omission element, we don't have the in connection with element, we don't have the purchase and sale element, we don't have the covered security element. In Rowinsky, the Third Circuit made clear that, at least in its opinion, which I don't think is inconsistent with what this court has said, that the law applicable to these kinds of relationships, meaning contract, fiduciary, and corporate law, are traditionally relegated to the states for regulation. Alliance Capital wants to say because of SLUSA, which has been interpreted almost exclusively in a broker-dealer or an issuer context, investment advisory clients now can't sue the investment advisors for breaching the agreements in place between investment advisors and the investment advisory clients. There is simply no authority for that position. It's a leap that is so vast that it seems patently to fail. I'd like to follow up again with Norman. They say plaintiff's claim is simply that Solomon said it would do something in exchange for plaintiff's fees and then didn't do what it had promised. Again, that's the claim in this case. Both Herb and Aladdin are claiming that Alliance Capital said it would do something in exchange for fees, and it didn't. Now, the fees that were to be paid and that were paid to Alliance Capital, again, not in connection with the purchase or sale of a security, at least not directly. Clearly, there were securities bought in these portfolios. There's no question about that. The fees were based on the dollars under management at Alliance Capital. They didn't get a commission if they went out and bought shares of Qualcomm. They got paid a fee depending upon the dollars that were invested in the account portfolio. Just as in Norman, plaintiffs in this case alleged that Alliance Capital didn't do what it said it would do. The final description in Norman that I think is, again, so well-drafted in connection with its application to this case is as follows. The Norman Court said, this proposed class of plaintiffs were consumers of a comprehensive portfolio management product offered by Salomon, in which Salomon made all investment decisions and plaintiffs paid substantial fees. It's the same situation here. Ms. Erb through the Premier Growth Fund and Aladdin through its agreement with Alliance Capital consumed comprehensive portfolio management products and services offered by Alliance Capital. Alliance Capital made all of those decisions. Now, Alliance Capital, for reasons we understand because of the SLUSA law, which, of course, is completely different than the arguments that it would have made prior to SLUSA, wants to persuade this court that this really, truly is a securities fraud claim. It really isn't a breach of contract claim. And I think that this example might put that to rest. The claim, as the court knows from the complaints, is that Alliance Capital agreed to purchase large cap growth stocks for both the portfolio of the mutual fund and the portfolio of all other investment advisory clients. A large cap growth stock is, of course, just a big stock whose earnings are expected to grow over time. If Alliance Capital purchased small cap stocks, purchased little stocks, purchased penny stocks in the portfolio of the mutual fund for Barbara Erb or Aladdin, doesn't make any difference. If Alliance Capital, in performing its management services, purchased small cap stocks, would that be a fraud? Well, Alliance Capital could say, as the defendant did in the McGurry decision, which relied on this court's opinion in Consolidated Services versus Key Bank to find that SLUSA did not preempt contract claims, the defendant could say, well, we really thought we were doing the right thing for the client. We know we're supposed to buy large cap growth stocks here at Alliance. That's what our agreement says. But we thought there was this great opportunity. We wanted to take advantage. The market was moving towards small caps. We wanted to buy them. We didn't try to hurt you. We didn't do it for our benefit. We just thought that was a better decision. Alliance in that instance would still have breached its agreement with its clients because it has promised to purchase large cap growth stocks. It's no different in the case brought by Ms. Erb and Aladdin Industries. Ms. Erb and Aladdin Industries say, look, we've hired Alliance Capital, just as the plaintiff did in the Solomon case in the Southern District of New York, to provide portfolio management services. We don't want to pick the stocks. We don't want to buy stocks from you, Alliance. We don't want to sell stocks to you, Alliance. We want you to manage our portfolios. And we want you to do it in the way that you've promised to do it. And they've alleged that the large cap growth team promised to manage all portfolios identically, which counsel said to you again this morning during the defendant's opening argument, argument this morning. They were going to manage all the accounts the same. They were going to purchase only large cap growth stocks. And they were going to purchase stocks that had a rating of 1 assigned by Alliance's research analysts. I want to draw a distinction between the ratings in this case and ratings you might have read about in other cases involving broker-dealer research opinions. In this case, no one's questioning the integrity of Alliance Capital's research. No one's questioning the integrity of the opinions. No one is challenging Alliance saying you really didn't believe these were one-rated stocks or these weren't one-rated stocks. There's no element of that here, unlike all of the research analyst cases where all of those opinions are questioned on various grounds. You, Mr. Analyst, really didn't believe that, yet you wrote it anyway. That's read to be fraud. And through artful pleading, some plaintiffs have attempted to bring contract claims there. In this case, we don't make that allegation. In fact, we don't believe it. We think Alliance Capital's research was very good. We simply allege that they agreed to purchase only those stocks that very good research assigned a rating of 1 to. And for whatever reason, lack of attentiveness or a real desire to buy stocks that the portfolio managers thought were better but weren't rated one by the analyst. Doesn't matter why, they didn't do it. And they promised to do it. And by not doing it, they've breached their agreements with the fund, and they've breached their agreements with the individual portfolios, such as those by, such as that owned by Aladdin. The easy way to resolve this case would be to grant the motion to dismiss and simply find that the court lacks appellate jurisdiction. And I'd like to spend my last moment on Kircher, which I do believe dooms the argument of Alliance Capital in addition to the explanation that I've just provided. In the second Kircher opinion decided just last month, this court held, counsel for the plaintiff declined to explain how state law would support a direct action that did not rely on deceit or manipulation. Wasn't it the oral argument? I haven't read a transcript, but it's very clear from reading the opinion that the court wanted the plaintiffs in that case to suggest some theory under which they could proceed in a direct action that would not depend on deceit or manipulation. Make no mistake, in this case, there is a basis, not through artful pleading, but through traditional fiduciary, trust, and contract law, and that's the claim that has been pled by the Erbs, by Ms. Erb, and by Aladdin. And finally, if I may just read one other sentence, I see my time is up, Your Honor, but the final sentence says, nor does any of the suits assert that a mutual fund broke a promise so that state contract law would supply a remedy. Of course, that's exactly what we have done.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grady.
Thank you.
Is there any time left on that, or your time has expired? You may have 30 seconds if you have a reply.
Yeah, I believe that I reserve time for rebuttal.
Well, yeah, but you're the guardian of the rebuttal time, not me.
I understand, Your Honor. Just a couple of quick points. On the jurisdictional issue, the second complaint even changed the contract that was at issue. That's how significant the change was. The not in connection with requirement, certainly this is the first time we're hearing that is no longer conceded as it was below. The Dabbitt case says that where a breach of contract claim accrues only on the purchase of a security, the in connection with requirement has been met. That certainly has been done here. Plaintiffs obviously are bringing that up simply because now they want Norman to apply, and Norman is just in a posit here. We think it was wrongly decided. And the case is more like Green, where the Eighth Circuit said, if you're not talking about the purchase or sale of a security, there was fixed fees. Plaintiffs were seeking the return of fixed fees pursuant to a contract. If you're not talking about fixed fee, or where you are talking about fixed fees, there's no purchase or sale at issue, therefore the case can get remanded. We think Norman's more like that. One last thing, please, Your Honor, is the fact that we certainly have not conceded in any way, shape, or form that the institutional investors have stated a claim here. We don't think there's a contract at all that has those terms. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ma. Thank you, Ms. Grady. The case, and all counsel, the case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, Hudson versus Walmart.